Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. An obscure Texas child custody lawsuit has made it all the way to the doorstep of the United States Supreme Court. But long before that, investigative journalist Rebecca Nagel started paying attention. The more she and a team of reporters dug, the bigger and stranger and more suspicious the case became. One day, Nagel's colleague, Amy Westervelt, called her to say she'd unearthed something. A top Texas official had made this obscure custody suit his business, and his office showed up at a hearing in family court.
Who? The frickin' Texas Attorney General.
What?
Yes. That one, this, like, really shocked me because I...
In family court, the office of the Texas Attorney General and, like, some just, like, a, like some kid in foster care, they're intervening in that case to say that ICWA should be declared unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
What the hell? That's so bizarre.
Bizarre. Absolutely. And just the tip of the iceberg. Nagel and her team spent 4 years finding what lies beneath the surface. And they tell the story in season 2 of Nagel's crooked media podcast, This Land. Episode 5 dropped yesterday, and there is more to come. And Rebecca Nagel joins me today from Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Rebecca, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
The podcast is outstanding and extremely eye-opening. So let me just start with a first simple question. When you started looking at this custody case, which we'll hear more about in a second, did you have any inkling that it would be the doorway into this really massive, perhaps, earth-shaking lawsuit that could change Indian country forever?
I had suspicions. You know, this law, the Indian Child Welfare Act, in the past decade has been challenged more times than the Affordable Care Act. And it's a really odd group of people attacking it. It's private adoption attorneys, corporate lawyers, and this universe of right-wing money and operatives. And I wanted to know why. And so we put a team together and we spent the past year investigating. We talked to over 100 people. We submitted 60 FOIA requests. We went through thousands and thousands of pages of court documents. And I thought I was prepared for what we would found, but it turns out that I wasn't.
Yeah. Well, as you say in season 2 of the podcast, that there are people who are concerned that the very existence of tribes in the United States may be on the line because of this lawsuit. So let's dig in a little bit to what you found. First of all, for people who don't know what ICWA is, the Indian Child Welfare Act, explain it, a little bit of its history here.
Absolutely. And so I think one important historical context is that generations of Native children have been systematically removed from their families and tribes by the U.S. government. And so, you know, it started in the late 1800s and early 1900s with government-run boarding schools where children were beaten for speaking their languages, where many children died. And during that era, an estimated third of Native children were forced to go to those schools. And then in the 50s and 60s, the government had a new program that purposefully adopted Native children out and placed them with white families. And in the late 60s, a national survey found that 25 to 35% of all Native children had been removed from their family and tribes. And so in 1978, Congress passed the Indian Child Welfare Act, also often called ICWA. And what ICWA does is it's basically a set of protections for Native parents, for tribes, and especially for Native children to make sure that Native kids who are either in the foster care system or in an adoption situation stay with family, stay with their tribe, and stay connected to their community. And what's really important about ICWA is that what it lays out is actually what's best for all foster children. Research has shown that all foster children do better when they stay with family and when they stay in their community.
Mm-hmm. You know, many listeners might have relatively recently heard of or recently learned of what was done to Native children for, you know, two centuries, because as you also mentioned it in the podcast, in this land, the unearthing of all those unmarked graves in Canada's Indigenous residential schools in the past year, just thousands of Native children buried in unmarked graves there. I'll just give On Point a little plug here. We did an hour about those residential schools and also talked about how Canadian history is intimately tied to how Native children in the United States were treated, as Rebecca's pointing out, for two centuries, how this idea of genocide, essentially, through removing children from their families originated in the United States. So go to onpointradio.org to listen to that. But Rebecca, I want to play a moment from season two of This Land, where you spoke with Sandy Whitehawk, who's a citizen of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota, and she talked to you. I was walking home and I was listening to this, Rebecca. It stopped me in my tracks because Sandy described to you about how when she was a tiny little girl, she was just taken from her family and how her relatives were too terrified to intervene.
I've heard people say, we had a drill in our house that if a car drove up the driveway, we knew that it would be somebody from the government or social worker or something. I remember one of my uncles saying that he remembers the day that the social worker came and got me, drove into the driveway, and I was toddling around, and they were all sitting around the house, as far as I know. That's how it was told to me. And she just simply got out of the car, scooped me up, and put me in the car. Could you imagine that you knew not to move and not to do anything and not to grab me and fight for me? Because they would have been put in jail and I would have still been taken.
That's Sandy Whitehawk speaking to Rebecca Nagel in season two of Rebecca's podcast, This Land. So the Indian Child Welfare Act was designed to stop things like that from happening and to put the welfare of Native children center to these cases. Was it effective in doing that, Rebecca?
Yes. We don't have actually good national data. That's one of the things that needs to happen with ICWA, is that there needs to be better tracking and compliance. But the Casey family programs have collected pockets of data from ICWA courts. So there's actually some family courts that are set up that just do ICWA cases. And where there's good compliance with ICWA, we see good outcomes. So kids are more likely to be raised by relatives and actually less likely to age out of foster care, which is when children turn 18 and haven't been adopted by anyone. And so we do see some really good outcomes with ICWA. A few things that the law does is that it actually gives tribes a say in what happens in family court when those court cases involve their children. It also lets tribes move the cases to tribal court. And it also sets out placement preferences of where Native kids should go. And so the first preference is family members. The second preference is other members or other citizens of their tribe. And the last preference is other Native homes. And what's interesting is, you know, ICWA was kind of ahead of its time. It was passed in the late 70s. And what we've seen in the decades since then is that other child welfare policy has caught up to it. And so it's not only ICWA that says that kids should go with family members, but child welfare policies now across the board.
And as you point out in the podcast, it went through the legislative process by, you know, by definition as being an act of Congress here. So therefore, it took years, a decade, with research and all the intricacies of laws being passed, which is very different from the court case that you dug into, which we'll hear a bit more about in a second. But I did want to underscore something which is so important, and that is really how family structure is seen and lived in in tribal communities, because, you know, in non-tribal communities in the United States, you make a point to there's actually someone you speak with who says that as soon as parental rights are cut off, the rights of those children to see anybody else in their family essentially evaporates also, or becomes really, really difficult, which is completely the opposite of Native family structures and how family is seen. So I want to just play a moment from the podcast. This is Amber Knazba-Crotty, a delegate on the Navajo Council. And she explained to you that in Indian culture, there's a big extended family that raises a Native child. And when the courts decide to take a child away from its parents, they often wound not only the child, but the whole community.
Literally, when you see like a tree and the roots that are sprouting on the bottom and how they interconnect and intertwine and are there to support one another, that's the family structure. So it's not one or two individuals. It's this whole system, right? It's this whole system. It is important for our children's spiritual, mental, physical well-being to know who they are, and that this is theirs. This is a space and a place and a people who claim them and who will protect them.
We've got about 45 seconds before we're headed to our first break, Rebecca. But will you tell me why understanding this meaning of family is so important to understanding the bigger impact of the case that you followed in season two of This Land?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of times in these cases, people look at a toddler and say, oh, well, that child has been with this foster family for 6 months or a year, so it would be traumatic to separate them. But people don't think about the trauma of separating a Native person from their culture, from their language, from their tribe. You know, two of these children, actually, their family has lived within the land of Navajo Nation since the beginning of time. And this case took them away from that. And so there are deeper and longer connections that are being ignored.
Well, we're talking this hour with Rebecca Nagel. She's an investigative journalist and the host of the Crooked Media podcast, This Land. In season two of This Land, she explores a powerfully important case that could have an impact on all tribes in the United States. More when we come back. It's On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Rebecca Nagel. She's an investigative journalist and host of the podcast This Land. In season two of This Land, which is unrolling right now, Rebecca and her team tell us about a four-year investigation that they undertook to really understand what is happening with a major Supreme Court case that has to do with the adoption of Native children in this country. And it's about way more than those kids. Rebecca and her team uncovered corporate attorneys, potential land grabs, and a long-running effort to perhaps even put tribes at stake in the United States. So it's season two of This Land, and that's what we're hearing about this hour. And Rebecca, I want to play a little bit more from the podcast. You spoke with Christina and Corey Jones, who are friends of the couple who are at the heart of this custody case, Chad and Jennifer Brackeen. You couldn't speak to the Brackeens. They wouldn't do that. But you spoke to their friends, Christina and Corey Jones, who've also fostered numerous children for several years. And over those years, they told you that they came to realize that taking young children away from their families isn't something you do lightly. And here's what Corey told you.
We've done a lot of soul searching and of, I guess, for lack of a better term, repenting for just how we perceive people in general, and especially people who are poor. I mean, if we're honest, and I think especially those of us who come from like white conservative Christian backgrounds, we can certainly come at it with the white savior complex. And we believe we're not just helping kids, but we're also, you know, saving souls. And we're going to ride in on the white horse and save the day for these children. But I think it's something that foster parents are going to have to confront as well and check our own hearts and ask why we're really doing this. Like, are we doing this because we think this is how we finally make it into heaven by doing this really cool, noble thing?
It's Corey Jones speaking to Rebecca Nagel in season two of Rebecca's podcast, This Land. Now, again, Corey's friends with Chad and Jennifer Brackeen. They wouldn't speak to you, but tell us about the Brackeens and how they became foster parents.
So Chad and Jennifer Brackeen started to feel self-conscious about their wealth. Jennifer is a successful anesthesiologist. According to one home study we saw, her take-home pay is about $15,000 a month. So they're very well off. And they decided to share their wealth. They would become foster parents. They wanted to adopt, and they decided that their pathway to adoption would be foster care. Their first foster placement didn't go well. It was a three-year-old boy. And Jennifer, on her blog, talked about how the child was difficult and even suffocating. And after 5 months, they asked CPS to take the child back. Their second placement was a Navajo and Cherokee child that was about 1 year old. Before he was placed in her home, they were told that there was no hope that they would be able to adopt him. Interestingly, Chad didn't want to take the placement for that reason, but Jennifer thought it would be nice to have it, what she called on her blog, an easy baby. So they took the child, who in the podcast we call Antonio, that's not his real name, and they raised him for about a year. And I can really understand why somebody would bond with a child in that year. But it's actually how foster care works, is that parents have a year to work on their case plan. And during that year, Antonio wasn't available to be adopted by anyone. At the end of that year, unfortunately, his parents' rights were terminated. And within 2 months, Navajo Nation found a Navajo home that wanted to adopt the child. And that's when the Brackeens started fighting for custody. And the custody case was actually not what we expected. Mm-hmm. Because what happened is that they got some extremely powerful legal help that you do not normally see in family court, and then won custody relatively quickly.
This is such a twist in the podcast. When I got to it, Rebecca, I was like, what? Wait, so they had essentially already won. They had successfully adopted Antonio, and yet this battle over the case continues on? Why?
It's a real good question. And I hope it's one that actually the Supreme Court considers really seriously, because actually all of the underlying custody cases from when the federal lawsuit was filed have been settled. And so in a way, this lawsuit shouldn't exist. You know, I mean, it's sort of these non-native foster parents saying, you know, ICWA harmed me because it wouldn't let me adopt this native child, but they actually did adopt the native child. And when you look at the period of time, their first petitions to the court were denied, but then they came back with the help of a corporate law firm who has clients like Chevron and Amazon and Walmart and all of the resources that come with that. and the Attorney General of Texas. And then the case basically immediately went their way. And they found out that they were going to be able to adopt the child the same week they filed a federal lawsuit saying that the Indian Child Welfare Act was violating their constitutional rights.
Okay. So in most circumstances, this is when a case would come to its conclusion, right? Because they sought custody of Antonio and they got it. And yet, as we just said, it continues on. So tell me about this, oh gosh, the timeline that you uncovered. Bravo to investigative journalists like you and your team, because it's like, I don't want to say too much because I don't want to give it away. People should listen to the podcast, but it's this like lightning fast timeline that involves this really high powered law firm, Gibson Dunn. Now, can you tell us a little bit about who their other clients are and how they became, how they came around to representing the Brakeens?
Yes. So I think important context is that there's been a coordinated campaign to strike ICWA down for the better part of a decade. And so this obscure law has been challenged actually more times than the Affordable Care Act. And the players who are involved in these cases are well connected. And so the Brakeens heard of this adoption attorney who's well known for fighting ICWA named Mark Fidler, and they actually reached out to him and he connected them to Gibson Dunn. And then Gibson Dunn has a strong political relationship with the Texas Attorney General's office. They kind of have a revolving door of staff. And so they informed the Texas AG, hey, there's this custody case. Maybe you want to get involved. And the Texas AG got involved that way. And so basically, because there's this coordinated campaign to strike ICWA down, all non-native foster parents have to do is kind of put up the bat signal that they're, you know, involved in an ICWA case and they want to adopt the native children. And then all of a sudden, they have this entire legal arsenal at their disposal. And I think it actually raises some really serious ethical questions. You know, the plaintiffs say, you know, ICWA isn't what's the best interest of the child. It should be determined by the best interest of the child. But if you look at what happened in this custody case, it was really determined by power and money. And I think it's a real ethical question whether or not state AGs should be involved, you know, in determining who raises a two-year-old or if it should just be the regular family court proceeding. You know, the Texas AG actually went against his own child welfare department in this case.
Well, and then even more, they reached out to what, other states and said, you want to join this case?
Yes. And so there are four states that are all connected through an organization called the Republican Attorney General's Association that oppose ICWA in this case. And in those states are about 1% of all tribes in the United States. On the other side, there are 26 states in the District of Columbia that support ICWA. And those states, within the boundaries of those states, are 95% of all tribes. So not only is it odd that these states are fighting ICWA, but they're states with the tiniest ICWA caseload. And they also, these state AGs took on this case in opposition to their own child welfare department. And so Louisiana is one of the states. The AG called up, you know, their leader of their child welfare department and said, you know, what do you think about ICWA? And that, I think it's the commissioner, I'm not exactly sure her title, but she said, you know, ICWA's a great law. We have a great working relationship with the tribes. We think it's a good law. And then she was surprised to see a few days later, the AG sign on to this case. And so for them to say that it's about a problem that their child welfare department is having with ICWA, our investigation found the opposite.
So just to recap here, it begins with a single custody case. And as you told us, Rebecca, and your team uncovered, it's also part, then becomes part of a much longer story of attempts to overturn or get rid of the Indian Child Welfare Act. It spreads to several states who their child welfare departments say, no, ICWA's working great. It's protecting children. And yet there's this concerted organized high-powered effort to continue to push this case through the court. So, of course, as you keep asking in the podcast, why, especially when the families are at the center of it, won their adoption proceedings. So Let's play a moment from the This Land podcast where Rebecca spoke with Kevin Washburn, former Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs and a citizen of Chickasaw Nation. And he said that heavy-hitting law firms like Gibson Dunn, whose other clients include, what, Chevron, right, are pouring their energies into these small child custody cases for different reasons. And here's what some of those legal theories Kevin Washburn says might what they are.
Some of these legal theories would put tribal gaming at risk in the same way they put the Indian Child Welfare Act at risk. And it might be too obvious to do it in the gaming context, but if they can get the same legal result in the child welfare context, maybe they can then import it to the gaming context and, you know, strike at the legality of Indian gaming. So sometimes the Indian Child Welfare Act cases may be a stalking horse for gaming interests.
That's Kevin Washburn, former Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs and a citizen of Chickasaw Nation. So, Rebecca, this is where it all kind of blows open here. What is going on? What's really at the heart of this attempt to get rid of ICWA?
Right. Well, what Kevin was talking about using the same legal theories to attack ICWA, to attack tribal gaming, is actually how the attack on ICWA started. So, you know, there were fights over ICWA within adoption proceedings, but then this one high-profile custody case that went to the Supreme Court in 2013 was kind of the spark that ignited this fire of the attack on ICWA. And one of the most powerful lawyers in our country, a man named Paul Clement, was the person who brought that case. And he argued that ICWA is racial discrimination, that it treats Native children and foster parents. It treats Native children differently than non-Native children. It treats non-Native foster parents or adoptive parents differently than Native adoptive or foster parents. And that's unconstitutional because you can't treat people differently based on race. What's interesting about Mr. Clement is that at the same time he took up this ICWA case and made this very specific race-based argument, he was making the same argument on behalf of a white casino developer who wanted to build a casino in Massachusetts but couldn't because a tribe had the right to build a casino there and was mad and so sued the state of Massachusetts using that same legal argument. And so it's not abstract, these connections. These lawyers who are making these legal arguments against ICWA have made the same legal arguments, not only on behalf of non-Native casino developers, but on behalf of non-Native casino developers fighting tribes. And the thinking is that it is more sympathetic to, you know, tell this story about this toddler being torn from the only home that they've ever known. And it's distracting from the bigger implications. And here's where we get to the real meat of the bigger implications. ICWA is not based on race because it only applies to Native children who are either enrolled in a tribe or eligible to enroll. And that's all of federal Indian law, you know, where tribes can operate a casino, where I can go and get healthcare, land rights, treaty rights, where I can go hunt and fish as a tribal citizen. All of that is based on the nation-to-nation relationship between my tribe, Cherokee Nation, and the U.S. federal government. But if ICWA is unconstitutional because it's based on race, it's like the first domino in a series of dominoes. So if ICWA is unconstitutional, well, what about the hospital where I go and get healthcare that would turn you away? Why can that hospital discriminate? You know, well, that's based on the treaty relationship between my tribe and the U.S. federal government. And so what people are worried about is that the worst case scenario for this case is that federal Indian law gets chucked out the window and that the unique and important political status of tribes is undermined. And it's not a coincidence that the clients of this law firm, namely casinos and oil, would make a lot of money if that happened.
Is it... I have to ask, because I'm sure some listeners are wondering right now, is this just – you're thinking about the potential worst-case scenario, but is that probable or not? Is it beyond what could be reasonably considered to happen if, say, something like ICWA got struck down?
Well, let's look at what's already happened with the case. So a U.S. federal district judge did exactly that. You know, he basically, he's a radical conservative judge in Texas, and he took the Indian Child Welfare Act and he chucked it out the window and said that it was racial discrimination. And so if the Supreme Court ruled the way he did, it would have that domino effect. It then went to an appeals court, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, a half step below the Supreme Court. And it was a 16-judge panel, and they were evenly split. They strike down a few narrow parts of the law, but that 16-judge panel was evenly split on whether basically the foundation of the legal status of tribes is constitutional. And so that's how close we are to a scary result in this case. And I think that, you know, we'll have to see what the Supreme Court will do. But it's terrifying to think that the Supreme Court is going to take it up and all of federal Indian law is on the table.
And again, based on the legal thinking that if ICWA was found unconstitutional on the basis of being racially prejudicial, that same logic would apply to all other federal treaties with tribal nations.
Yeah. Why are there congressional laws where tribes can operate casinos on trust land where non-native casino developers can't operate casinos? Why can tribal citizens access healthcare in a federally run healthcare program that non-native people can? Why do I have hunting and fishing rights that non-native people have? Why do tribes have land? You know, if we're just a racial group, is there any other racial group in the United States that has criminal and civil jurisdiction over areas of land? You know, and we're a political entity. We are indigenous nations that have existed since before the U.S. was a country. And so if we become a racial category, all of that goes away.
Well, you also mentioned Paul Clement. And just for folks who are wondering, yes, that's the same former Assistant Attorney General and Solicitor General of the United States. So a lot of powerful players here in this case. More in a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a little preview of what's coming up on tomorrow's show. We're going to be talking about President Biden's sweeping new COVID plan, which includes that vaccine mandate for employers who have more than 100 workers. So we're going to talk about the legal challenges there, the moral responsibility of government, and the preservation of individual civil liberties, and where the two ought to actually meet. So we're curious, if you're not yet vaccinated, we want to know if the new Biden plan is going to have an impact on you and if it's going to nudge you or help you change your decision about whether or not to get vaccinated. And if you're an employer who now falls under the new federal mandate, we want to know what impact that's going to have on you. Is it changing your plans? Are you going to get the assistance you need for the testing? Call us with your story. We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 for tomorrow on the program. Today, we're speaking with investigative journalist Rebecca Nagel. She is the host of the Crooked Media podcast, This Land, which is in season 2 right now, and Rebecca and her team spent 4 years going deep to understand what's really happening with a critical case that has made its way up to the Supreme Court, which begins with the question of a white couple that wished to adopt a native child, but expanded very quickly, as Rebecca uncovered, into a much broader campaign and a much bigger issue that could threaten the existence of native tribes in this country altogether. Again, this is all in season two of This Land, and episodes 6, 7, and 8 air on the next 3 Mondays. So there's a lot more to come. But Rebecca, can we go back to the Brekkies for a moment here? Because in the podcast and through the blog that you found, they sound like a very well-intentioned, loving couple who simply wanted to give a child a home. Do you think that they became aware of what their case was really turning into, and did they mind it at all?
You know, I can't speak to that with any certainty, but I think that the Brekkies felt a calling, a religious calling, to adopt. The lawsuit actually involves three non-native foster families. The other two foster families really wanted to adopt just because they were trying to have children through adoption. And I think that, we found a lot of factual inaccuracies and discrepancies between what we were able to piece together happened in the actual custody cases and what's been presented both in federal court and in their interviews with the media. And I think one thing that happens in, we think that lying often is black and white, but I think often before we lie to other people, we lie to ourselves. And I think that what happened with these couples is that they were so desperate to have a child or to keep the child that they were fostering that they convinced themselves that it was best for the child. But when you look at the underlying custody cases, their reasons for that run afoul. One of the plaintiffs, Danielle and Jason Clifford, they were fostering a child whose grandmother wanted custody of her. And at one point they were saying that grandmother should no longer have any contact with the child. And they wrote this whole affidavit about why. And the main reason that they gave was that grandma had bad boundaries. And the example of grandma having bad boundaries was all of the gifts that she gave to her grandchild. She gave her grandchild a card from her mom when it was Christmas time. Instead of giving just one gift from a list of pre-approved gifts, she brought like a trunk load of presents. And I think that the Cliffords believed what they were writing, but when you look at it, it seems almost cruel to say that that's inappropriate. And so I think that there's this twisted logic that is used in the underlying custody cases to advocate what's best for the children. The Brekkies actually fought for and won custody of a second native child over that child's blood relative. And they actually hadn't fostered that child, and that she hadn't lived in their home. And in the custody testimony, Chad talked about the reason why he was a better parent for that child over a Navajo home and over her blood relative was about the size of his house. And that he was worried that when she got to be a teenager, she wouldn't have her own bedroom. And would she really have privacy? And did this aunt really have enough money to take care of her child? And so it really becomes layered with class. And I think these problematic ideas about what is quote unquote best for children.
Well, poverty is consistently used to accuse parents of being of bad parenting. And in fact, in the first episode of season two of This Land, you go over the history of how just the presumption of Native parents as being bad parents with no evidence, right, has been used against Native families for generations.
And I would argue that it's still happening. Yeah. And so, just a couple statistics. In Minnesota, One in three Native kids will enter foster care before they turn 18. One in 10 Native babies will enter foster care before their first birthday. Nationally, Native babies have about a 1 in 100 chance. And when you look at the reason that these children are being removed, for the most part, it's not abuse. It's this sort of more ambiguous category of neglect. And often the underlying issues of neglect are poverty. And I would say what also happened in these cases is, you know, the biological parents, in all the cases, the biological parents were struggling with substance abuse, but there was another relative that either wanted to raise the child or was already raising the child. And it's those extended relatives that the system consistently pushed out.
Well, and so that brings us to the case of Piper, right? The other child there were three families, you said, and this was the second one involved in this anti-ICWA case, if I can just call it that. Now, what legal teams and legal advocates often do in terms of constructing a strategy that they think will be most successful in the courts is they look for, quote unquote, the perfect case, right? Or the perfect plaintiff. So they have their legal strategy set out and they just need to find someone's name and someone's story to put on the case. And it's a very, very common practice, which has happened here. And the perfect case, as you've uncovered it, Rebecca, has to do with Danielle, and Jason Clifford, who you just mentioned, in Hennepin County, Minnesota. And so I just want to play a moment from season two of This Land, where we hear from the little girl who you call Piper, from her grandmother, who was already taking care of Piper when they were separated. And here's Grandmother Robin, a citizen of the White Earth Nation.
We made a drum.
She's going to go get it. She wants to show you. She's starting to speak Ojibwe language. I got words up on the wall there, you know. I wrote them down for her and we'll say them together, you know. Did you find your drum?
Mm-hmm.
Our drum? I thought it was on the wall.
Oh, yeah, it's in the wall. So in this giant handle right here in the back, we put a rock in there, and this drum is made of deer skin, and yeah, well, she was making it, and I went to her and helped her finish it, and we left it there to dry, and it has both of our names on it.
That's Piper you just heard, and a little earlier, her grandmother, Robin. Can you tell us a little bit more about this case and how they got drawn into this battle against ICWA?
Yeah, it's a really hard case to talk about. When Piper, which is not her real name, I should say, was about three, her family became homeless. Robin actually tried to get into a shelter with Piper, but she wasn't allowed in because she wasn't Piper's biological parent. And so Piper's dad took her for a while and was pulled over with drugs and drug paraphernalia in the car. And so, and with her mom in the car too. And so her parents went to jail and she went into foster care. Robin immediately tried to be her placement, but a social worker actually wouldn't even let her apply for a foster care license, just told her no because Robin has a criminal record. And there's actually a legal process in Minnesota. It's called a set-aside, and the social worker didn't even let Robin know that was an option. And so Piper would spend the next 3 years in foster care in five or six homes. And in her last placement was with Danielle and Jason Clifford. And they wanted to adopt Piper. And what happened is that Robin's tribe, White Earth Nation, intervened, and then Hennepin County and the tribe agreed that Robin was the best adoptive placement. And so after 3 years of Piper being in foster care, she was reunited with her grandmother. She's been there ever since. She's now 10. And so she's been back with her grandmother, I believe, for about 4 years now. But the Cliffords say in custody in family court and are saying in federal court that they are the only stable home that Piper has ever known. And even though she was only with them for a year and a half and she's been with her grandmother for 7 years, it was harmful to Piper and it was harmful to them for her to be removed. And I think that the Robin story is really sad. You know, she did everything that she could to keep her granddaughter with her and basically couldn't get help until she got help from her tribe. And I think that that's a really, her story really illustrates why ICWA is needed. Because if that first meeting had gone differently and that social worker had just really done her job and followed the law, instead of this little three-year-old spending, you know, the next 3 years and half of her life by the time she was six in foster care, she could have just gone to live with her grandmother in that first week that she was in foster care.
I want to get back to, we've got about 4 minutes left here, Rebecca, and I want to get back to the fact that it seems as if these efforts to strike down ICWA are a Trojan horse into larger interests, right? You mentioned the casino industry that would love to be able to put casinos on essentially tribal land, but they are not. These are not tribal companies we're talking about.
And the difference with casinos is that, so gaming is regulated by states, but tribal gaming isn't. Uh-huh. And so in states where non-native casinos can't build any casinos, tribes can. And some of those states are really big markets, like California. And so, you know, it's a unique law and a unique set of laws and court decisions. But, you know, the casino market is only so big and tribes take up 50% of it. And so, yeah.
Well, and then so that's not the only moneyed interest here, right? Because if we're talking about tribal land eventually that could, you know, come under scrutiny if ICWA were to be struck down, it's what technically is 2% of the United States. But what's on that land is more than $1 trillion worth of natural resources, right? So can you tell us, money, when powerful interests are at play, money has got to be at the heart of it. So who else is funding this effort to strike down the Indian Child Welfare Act?
Yeah, well, we actually found a paper trail, and we're going to cover this in depth in the episode that comes out next week, that ties the early stages of this attack and who was funding it and why to an effort to build what they called conservative state infrastructure, but basically conservative power through litigation. And so in the mid-2010s, there was this effort by a big conservative family foundation to build conservative state power. They sent out an RFP, and basically ICWA was a tool that was laying around. And if you look at how this case is functioning and what it's doing in the courts, it's following that agenda. You know, if conservatives wanted to take ICWA down in Congress, they wouldn't have the votes. There's actually bipartisan support for ICWA in Congress. But they are already dangerously close to gutting or striking down this law entirely by taking their case to federal courts. And we'll lay that out more clearly in the next episode. But it was a shock to me because I thought the heart of it was about tribes and tribal sovereignty. And we found out that the attack on tribes is actually part of this even bigger agenda.
Can you give us a little preview about when is the Supreme Court likely to take this up or hear the case?
You know, we don't know that yet for sure, but it'll probably be argued this spring, and then we'll get the decision in June.
Okay. Well, we've got about a minute left here, Rebecca. And let me just ask you, you're also a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. I just wonder, you're an investigative journalist first and foremost. You go where the facts and the evidence take you, and you're a member of Cherokee Nation as well. I'm just wondering how spending 4 years on this story, how did it have an impact on you?
I've reported on a lot of hard things, you know, violence against Native women, missing and murdered Indigenous women, what's happening with the coronavirus in our communities. And I would say that this is the most demoralizing thing that I've ever looked into. You know, what happened to these children, but I think also really I think what got me was talking to the family members who didn't win custody and the loss that those families are living with. It's a heartbreaking case. And I would also say that, you know, the media has really, for the most part, gotten the story wrong because they didn't do the investigating that we did. And so there are facts in major papers that are just inaccurate. Mm-hmm. And so I think that people really need to start asking the hard questions about this case that we asked.
Well, that's why I urge everyone listening to subscribe to the This Land podcast. It's season 2, where Rebecca Nagel and her team go through in way more detail than we just touched upon here in this hour about what's really happening with this ICWA case. So Rebecca Nagel, host of the Crooked Media podcast, This Land, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.